Okay, well, if you have your Bibles, we're in Psalm 77 this evening, and I've titled the message here, Cure for the Troubled Soul, and you say, well, my soul's not troubled. Well, give yourself 24 hours. You know, we all have some trouble. As sparks fly upwards, you're just as sure there's going to come trouble into the life, as Job says, and so we all wrestle with all kinds of things in life. He begins this psalm with, to the chief musician, to Jeduthun, a psalm of Asaph. When he says to the chief musician, this is thought to have probably been a key leader, choir leader, or a key musician in David's time. Jeduthun is also mentioned in Psalm 39 and Psalm 62, and he was one of the musicians appointed by David to lead in worship. And then Asaph, it says a psalm of Asaph. Asaph was a singer, musician. Scripture also says he was a prophet. And so he was a major worship leader in the time of David and Solomon as well. Note on the overhead, the outline here, verses 1 through 9, seeking God, remaining troubled. You just can't find relief in verses 1 through 9. Then 10 through 15, refocusing on God, and verses 16 through 20, illustrations of God's past leading. So let's begin. Psalm 77, verse 1. I cried out to God with my voice, to God with my voice, and he gave ear to me. So he cries out to God. There's a double emphasis here. He's pleading. He's crying out to God. And he is convinced that indeed God did hear him. He has no doubt. God is listening. God hears my plea. Verse 2, in the day of my trouble I sought the Lord. My hand was stretched out in the night without ceasing. My soul refused to be comforted. So we don't know again what the exact occasion was for this psalm, but obviously it was urgent, it was intense, and he knew where to go. He went to the Lord, which is the right place, sought the Lord intently, it says, in the night without ceasing, and yet he found no relief. You know, we often just say, well, just pray about it. He's praying about it, and still he doesn't feel like there's relief. My soul refused to be comforted. Verse 3, I remembered God and I was troubled. I complained and my spirit was overwhelmed. Selah. You know, I think he's thinking, well, you know, why isn't God working on my behalf? Nothing's happening. Ever have a season like that? I'm praying, but nothing's happening. I think that's the situation here. He was seeking help from God. He was miserable. He's overwhelmed. David Gazik says, the sense is, God, I know you're there. Why won't you help me the way I need to be helped? And then he says, Selah. Reflects a pause. Stop and meditate on this. Now, if we're honest, there are times when it just seems like nothing is happening, no matter how hard we might be praying. We believe in prayer. We believe God is hearing. And yet we find no comfort in the struggle. This is pretty honest stuff here. We're all human. We all know the struggle. He says, verse 4, you, he's talking to God, you hold my eyelids open. It's not like you're not allowing me rest here. I just continue on with the struggle. I am so troubled I cannot speak. Seems like he's progressing in his depression. Things are getting worse. Since God is not responding, it's as if he is holding God responsible for his sleeplessness. And he has gotten himself so worked up that it's like he can't even speak anymore. Now, earlier he was crying out to God continually, as we saw in the first couple of verses, but now he can't even speak. He's reduced to silence. Someone has said, his woes are too big for utterance. Kind of reminds me of Job when his friends found him. They sat in silence with him for 7 days. And I think that's an expression of great, intense internal suffering. Verse 5, then he says, I have considered the days of old, the years of ancient times. So he's thinking about the past here. I call to remembrance my song in the night. I meditate within my heart, and my spirit makes diligent search. So he thinks back on happier times and calls to remembrance when he used to have a song in the night. J. Vernon McGee, now where did I put my, there it is. It's right where I left it. Here we are. J. Vernon McGee. The night is a time when you wake up and worry. Problems loom large. Everything in the dark looks bigger than it really is. that is the time to remember your song in the night. Yeah, it's kind of true sometimes. You have this experience, you wake up in the night, and boy, all of a sudden your mind is flooded with all kinds of things. It is amazing how the darkness kind of does seem to amplify these things. But here he says he's remembering his song in the night, but it's one thing to remember your song in the night and another thing to sing it. And at this point, he's not singing. He's remembering. He's not singing. He's sighing. He's remembering how God worked in times past that brought a song in the night, but that's not his experience now. It's almost like this remembrance has deepened his depression, his spiritual depression. Why can't he see those times once again, even now? Why is there just silence? Well, as he considered these things, it's like he tries to figure it out here. When he says, my spirit makes diligent search. He meditates on these things. He's searching for answers. And that, again, too, is so human. When things are going badly, we desperately try to figure it out. We try to make sense of it. Our spirit makes diligent search. And again, if we're very honest, in the really hard times, we too may have known these kinds of struggles. Charles Spurgeon, we know him as the Prince of Preachers, and boy, everybody quotes Charles Spurgeon yet to this day, and what a great preacher he was, great man of God. But Spurgeon studies, this comes from James Montgomery Boyce, he says, Spurgeon studies of the Psalms were produced between 1865 and 1885. And during those 20 years, he experienced much ill health, which continued to deteriorate until his death in 1892. He had health problems and gout, which left him so swollen, red, painful limbs, so that he frequently could not walk or even write. He had debilitating headaches, and with these physical ills came frightful bouts of depression, leading almost to despair. Well, in that context, Spurgeon wrote of this psalm that we're studying tonight, "Alas, my God, the writer of this exposition well knows that your servant Asaph knows what your servant Asaph meant, for his soul is very familiar with this way of grief. Deep, narrow valleys and lonely caves of soul depressions. My spirit knows full well your awful glooms." Well, he went through it, and he was thinking about Psalm 77. You know what? Hard times are hard times. There's nothing easy for anyone in going through deep depressions, the deep depressions of life. And at some time, almost everyone will face this type of challenge on some level, even the most spiritual among us. Asaph now asks six questions, and they can be taken in the sense of, taken a couple of different ways. You could take this in the sense of self-talk, in the sense of rhetorical questions. Taken this way, he knows the answer to each question is no. But really, to jar himself out of the spiritual depression he's in, he asks himself these jarring rhetorical questions, even though he knows better. There's a well-known story about Martin Luther. And he was in a serious bout of depression one time. And his wife, Katharina, she one day dressed up in all black, put on a veil, in an attempt to prompt Luther out of this bout of deep depression. Well, Luther couldn't help but note, this is kind of weird. You're all dressed up in black, got a black veil on. What is going on here? And so he asked her, what's this about? And she says, well, God died. And he's looking at her like, what is wrong with you? And she said, that's how you're acting. You're acting like God died. Well, she made the point with him, and she was attempting to jolt him out of this time of despair by reminding him of God's faithfulness. He is still the living God. Well, sometimes I think we need to be jolted with some serious self-talk to bring us back to where we need to be. The other way we can take these six questions here of despair, which are questions of despair, it would seem to me, or how Asaph, it's really reflective of how he was feeling at this time. And this really is emotions talking. He knows better. I think he really knows better. But this is how he's feeling. And so that's probably how we should take this. Notice what he says here, verse 7, 8, and 9. Will the Lord cast off forever? And will he be favorable no more? Has his mercy ceased forever? Has his promise failed forevermore? Has God forgotten to be gracious? Has he in anger shut up his tender mercies? Selah. Will the Lord cast off forever? Well, of course not. But in the moment, he felt like this. Will God never show favor again? Of course not. But in the moment, he emotionally wondered. Has God's mercy, that, and really the word here is hesed, his unfailing faithfulness, ceased to be? Of course not. But in the moment, his emotions were leading to question. Has God's promise failed? Of course not. But in the moment, he wondered, how does this work out? Has God forgotten to be gracious? Of course not. But momentarily, it felt like it. Has God in anger closed himself off to mercy, that is compassion? Of course not. But again, at the time, it felt that way. And then he says, Selah, Selah. Stop and think about this. Stop and meditate on this. I think this is quite human to go through down times, discouraging times. Where is God right now in this? David Gazik says, Asaph spoke things that believers rarely feel safe to speak about. Many believers won't risk this kind of honesty. Asaph's honest anguish is worthy of contemplation. Very brutally honest. Stop and soak in the ramifications of these six questions. Of course, they're preposterous. If any of them were really true, the God of the Bible wouldn't be whom we know him to be. Still, in the deep depression of the struggle, emotionally, even God's children wrestle with all kinds of thoughts like this sometimes. You say, well, if you were a true Christian, you wouldn't do that. But hold on here, partner. You might want to think about that for just a little bit. You might want to have a Selah here. Spurgeon again says, if you are a child of God and yet never had to ask these questions, you ought to be very grateful. But if you have had to ask them, be very thankful that Asaph asked them before you, and believe that as he had a comfortable answer to them, so shall you. It's always a comfort when you can see the footprints of another man in the mire and the slough, for if that man passed through unharmed, so may you, for his God shall be your helper also. Ah, good point. Verse 10. And I said, this is my anguish, but I will remember the years of the right hand of the Most High. Verse 10 now denotes a change of focus. Yes, this has been the anguish that his soul has been going through. But at this point, he determines that he will focus on the history of God's faithfulness and how he has worked on behalf of his people in the past. And that's a great place to go. In the battle, we cannot let our emotions, our feelings, win the day. Yes, we might have all kinds of emotional experience and all kinds of feelings, but we can't let that rule us. Rather, we must come back to what we know is true and function accordingly. As they say, never doubt in the dark what you have come to know is true in the light. I don't know if you've seen this, but it's, you know, there's truth here. You got to train your mind to be stronger than your feelings or you're going to lose. What's going to rule the day here? Of course, we can't do anything without God's help and strength. But in the battle, there is often a gap between what we really believe and what we emotionally feel. That's a very important point here. In the battle, there is often a gap between what we really believe, down deep, what we really believe and what we emotionally feel. You know, that's part of being human. That's part of the struggle here. That's part of spiritual warfare. We have to bring it back to what we have come to know about God. This must be our resting place or we'll have no rest at all. That's his testimony here, really. The years of the right hand of the Most High refer to the times when his power was clearly on display for all to see. In those days, his power was seemingly unhindered. When his strength, symbolized by his right hand, was clearly evident on behalf of his children. And he's going to go on to talk about the Exodus here. You know, the Exodus is one of the major events in the Old Testament, and God's power, his right hand was clearly on display. Exodus 15:6, your right hand, O Lord, has become glorious in power. Your right hand, O Lord, has dashed the enemies in pieces. Verse 12, you stretched out your right hand, the earth swallowed them. So notice what he says here now. Verse 11, I will remember the works of the Lord. Surely I will remember your wonders of old. I will also meditate on all your work and talk of your deeds. At this point, Asaph has determined to focus on the works of the Lord and how he has miraculously worked in times past. He will meditate on these things, and he says, and talk of them. Here he has determined to focus on really a three-step process to bring about healing and encouragement. Number one, he will remember God's great workings in the past. Number two, he will meditate on those things. And number three, he will speak of these things with others. At this point, this is his determination to focus on God things in remembering, meditating, and talking. It's a good strategy for depression, for spiritual depression. Focus totally on God in remembering, meditating, and talking. Maybe talk about God and not just about yourself. Meditate on God and what he has done and what he is able to do. This is a great prescription for the cure of a troubled soul. Verse 13, your way, O God, is in the sanctuary. Who is so great a God as our God? See, the focus now is all God. It's God. By the way, most translate this as your way, O God, is holy. My New King James, in the sanctuary, your way, O God, is holy, preferred translation here. Holy means that God is set apart. There is none like him. He is totally unique, incomparable. And so he says, who is so great a God as our God? And of course, the answer is no one. Well, as he focuses on God, he sees once again what a great and incomparable God he is. Verse 14, you are the God who does wonders. You have declared your strength among the peoples. When he says he does wonders, he's saying he is a wonder-working, that is a miracle-working God. Wonders are miracles that cause wonder and awe. God has shown himself powerful among the peoples. And he did this time and time again in the history of Israel. You want to see the truth of the miracle-working God? Study the history of Israel, where it was clearly on display. And then, of course, most prominently in the ministry of the Lord Jesus Christ, where it was personified all the more. Verse 15, you have with your arm redeemed your people, the sons of Jacob and Joseph, Selah. Redeemed is the idea of rescue. Many times through the years, from Jacob to Joseph, God rescued his people from all kinds of troubles. Selah, he is a God of deliverance. This is a matter of history. And now he proceeds to illustrate this. Verse 16. The water saw you, O God. The water saw you. They were afraid. The depths also trembled. Now there's a basic consensus here that this is really talking about when God brought his people through the Red Sea. The waters are personified as being afraid and shrinking back at the awesome presence of God. Verse 17. And 18, the clouds poured out water, the sky sent out a sound, your arrows also flashed about, your voice of thunder was in the whirlwind, the lightnings lit up the world, the earth trembled and shook. Now it's interesting here, because if indeed this is the occasion of God bringing his people through the Red Sea, the details are not found in Exodus 14, which is the historical record of this in the Old Testament. But they evidently happened in conjunction with this Exodus event, as brought out here. James Montgomery Boyce says, either these are details missing from the original account but preserved in the historical memory of the people, or they are a poetic embellishment of the incident. One of the two. The Jewish historian Josephus definitely thought they were literally a part of the Exodus story as recorded here. And he goes on in his commentary to bring that out very clearly. Verse 19, your way was in the sea, your path in the great waters, and your footsteps were not known. This is a great verse. I really like this verse. This speaks of God's miraculous workings in displaying his power over nature. His all-powerful way was seen in his control over the sea. It is thought that the same between the devil and the deep blue sea, which depicts a very difficult situation involving two equally unfavorable options, it goes back to this occasion where Pharaoh had the children of Israel, Pharaoh kind of representing the devil working behind him, and they're up against the deep blue sea, between the devil and the deep blue sea. Well, that's where they were. And you know what they were? They were terrified. But you remember what Moses said? Moses said to them, he said to the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see again no more forever. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord." He was about to do one of the greatest miracles in the history of the world, and he's going back to this. This is our God. Nothing is too hard for him. Your way was in the sea. Indeed, it was. Just to finish out the story, Exodus 14, 21, 22, Moses stretched out his hand over the sea. The Lord caused the sea to go back. That must have been a sight. Whoa, what's happening here? By a strong east wind all that night, and made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. So the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on the left. What an amazing phenomenon. There's a wall over here, wall of water, wall over here. You ever seen anything like this? Nope, Johnny, I haven't seen anything like this. What is this? Well, this is a miracle. We're right in the middle of a miracle right now. Well, as the story continues, to get to the chase here, verse 23, and the Egyptians pursued and went after them into the midst of the sea. You might want to give some real pause here. I mean, think about all the miracles, the ten great miracles that had gone on before, the miracles of judgment on. You might want to think about, should we do this? Egyptians pursued, went after them into the midst of the sea, and all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. So they all went in. Verse 27, and Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and when the morning appeared, the sea returned to its full depth while the Egyptians were fleeing into it. So the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. Your way was in the sea. Thus God did wonders and declared his strength among the peoples. God had his way in the sea. He made a path, it says, in the great waters. And although his footsteps were not seen or known, he led his people all the way. You see, even God's people didn't see how God would work. He says, stand still and see. Watch, God is out leading us. The Egyptians failed to see before it was too late, but God had his way in it all. William Cowper wrote this many years ago. God moves in a mysterious way his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. What a great comfort this truth is. Whatever storm we happen to be going through, God has his way. Your way was in the sea, your path in the great waters, and your footsteps were not known. We don't have God figured out. His footsteps are not known. Why are you taking us this way? Why are you putting us between the devil and the deep blue sea? Well, I got a way through. I love that verse. Your way was in the sea, your path in the great waters, and your footsteps were not known. Who knows how God's going to work? His way is mysterious, often, but he's still God. He's in control. Verse 20. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. God worked miraculously as a great shepherd in leading his people like a flock. And yet at the same time, he did it by the hand of Moses and Aaron. Isn't that interesting? He really didn't need Moses and Aaron, but he used people in this process. Here we have that mysterious but wonderful mixture of God's sovereign shepherding. And yet at the same time, the use of human shepherds whom we often refer to as under-shepherds, as we like to call ourselves as elders. William MacDonald says, in the first 10 verses, Asaph has a king-sized case of introspection. The personal pronouns I, me, and my are found over 20 times, while the names of God are found only 7 times, and pronouns referring to God 7 times. And there is a distinct change at verse 10. In the last 10 verses, the personal pronouns are found only 3 times, whereas the nouns and pronouns referring to deity are used over 20 times. There's a flip-flop when it gets to verse 10. Our focus makes all the difference. G. Campbell Morgan wrote, the message of this psalm is that to brood on sorrow is to be broken and disheartened, while to see God is to sing on the darkest day. Once we come to know that our years are of his right hand, there is light everywhere. He's always in control. All of our times are really in his right hand, if we could see it. Asaph had some difficult times. He went through some difficulties during this troubling period, but in the end, he came to focus on God's shepherding care of his people. That's where he rests. There's a reason that Psalm 23 has been one of the favorite psalms of God's people through the years, right? You've probably memorized Psalm 23, haven't you? The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not lack. God's your shepherd. How is it? You think he's going to leave you? He's a good shepherd. We too can trust the great shepherd to lead us in whatever we're going through. For he is not only a great shepherd, he's also a good shepherd. We can trust him. Let's stand and have our closing song, and I'll close in prayer.